Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and here we are for another week. Today we got Mr. Michael Hawley in
the Buffalo. House. That's right. Hi, Alan. In the house.
He's in the house. And yeah, so there's no room for anybody now. Well, Mr. Hawley, what's new? You made it back from L.A. and they never.
Yeah. History's greatest mysteries. And I'm in the second half of the season. So they start this month and the Jack the Ripper episode is probably going to be in April.
Well, they're probably going to be canceled by then.
Oh, that's not good.
That'll be interesting. That'll be great.
And I don't even get to speak about my suspect that I researched. They just wanted the general expert of that. So it'll be fun. Too bad I didn't get to meet Lawrence Fishburne when I was there. That would have been really neat.
Who we've got here is Nick Quantrell. So thank you for being here, Nick.
No, pleasure. Great to join you guys. Looking forward to it.
Yes, absolutely.
So Nick here. Now, I've noticed you've got this, I guess it's Joe Girardi book series that you're talking about here. And you've got book four that just came out, or I guess it's probably been a year, right, or something. Yeah, September 20. So Nick Girardi, who is Nick, or Joe, who is Joe Girardi? I was going to say, Joe Girardi's probably Nick, right?
Well, you always say, don't write yourself, don't they, like that? So no Joe Girardi is a small-time private investigator, and he kind of lives and works in my home city of Hull, the United Kingdom, which is this kind of like northern isolated city that's sort of post-industrial. You know, it's kind of been kicked and battered and trodden on by the government for decades, and it's kind of coming back up again a little bit at the moment, but I kind of wanted to sort of use that classic US template of the private investigator and set it in the north of England to see if it would work. You know, I didn't want to write another cop. You know, there's so many kind of great cop novels out there, isn't there, that I needed to kind of think of something different. And that's where Joe came from, this idea of having a private investigator who doesn't have a femme fatale walking into his office every 5 minutes. He doesn't have a bottle of whiskey in his drawer. He doesn't walk around the city full wearing a fedora because, you know, you'll probably get a bit of a slap for doing that. So he's... it's a small-time private investigator who kind of finds himself in an awful lot of trouble throughout these series of books. And as you say, Sound of the Sinners is the latest one, and that's the fourth. I'm calling it the fourth in my trilogy because I didn't expect to write it. So it's kind of, it was a bit of a bonus book, I think, for me.
That's interesting. When you say you didn't mean to write it and it's the fourth in the trilogy, I always wonder because when you're doing a series with one main character like this, do you have this all outlined? Do you kind of know what's going to happen to Joe over a period of several books, and then you sort of write the books to fill that story? Or is it just by the seat of your pants?
It's kind of by the seat of my pants, I think, because I wrote the first three. It's kind of a cut out of trilogy. I did kind of know where I'd want him at the end of that book, and that was with him walking away from his home of Hull. And those books were published by Cafe Knights, a small UK crime press. And when they closed the doors to crime, I got the rights back. Fahrenheit Press got in touch and wanted to republish them, which was great. But kind of the condition of the deal was that I wrote a new Joe Geraghty novel to go with them. So I'd kind of had this gap between book three and book four where I had to think about what Joe had been doing and where he'd been and what would bring him back, what would make him come back home, back to Hull, and, you know, what would that be? And kind of, it was kind of like a structure that I had to work with and play with if I didn't start writing it. But essentially, that kind of arc of Joe as a character is kind of seat of the pants. I think, you know, it's kind of like peeling back an onion that I learn something new every time I write about him. You know, there's no kind of end game as such. It's just kind of, I'm kind of discovering it as I write in many ways, I think.
You know, as we get into the character of Joe, how much of you is in that? Like, is investigation, is that something you've always wanted to do or something you have experience with?
No, it's not. No, I mean, I think I've just always been a massive crime fiction fan. You know, as a reader, probably 90% of what I read is crime novels of, you know, of all stripes and colours. You know, it can be kind of hard-boiled stuff through to psychological mysteries or, you know, even a cozy mystery. You know, it's just, I'm always fascinated by, I guess, by crime. I studied criminology and social policy when I was younger, and I think that was kind of where it came from. You know, that sense of trying to understand the world around you, and I think crime fiction allows you to kind of make sense of it in a way that other books don't necessarily do so. So, you know, for me, crime has always been a way of exploring the world as a place, but also my home city as well. You know, I think that was probably the most important thing. It's kind of me having a conversation with myself about my home city. So, yeah, you know, Joe's kind of a tool for doing that, I think, more than anything. You know, he's not me. I'm not kind of, you know, I wish I kind of had his toughness, I guess, in some respects, but he is just a tool for me to explore my city, I think.
Yeah, and sometimes it's good to put yourself in that outlet. I mean, Joe can be the character, like you said, and do things that you wished you could have done, but you can't in regular life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's just a way of exploring a place, isn't it, from a different perspective, I think. You know, like, I wouldn't be able to go and knock on certain doors in the city. You know, Joe has a reason to do that and a drive to do that. And he kind of is propelled by that need for justice for whoever he's kind of working on behalf of or for himself. So, yeah, you know, it's a tool really to explore those feelings and those darker emotions, I think, without leaving the safety of your own house, I suppose, when it comes down to it. But yeah, you know, that's how I see Joe, really. He's kind of my tool for exploring a city that's kind of changing around me constantly.
So your city, so what is it about you that you want to explore it so much that it's a big part of the books? I would take it, this is my opinion, that in these books, the city itself, like especially Hull, right? That's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. That in itself is almost a character in its own.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think so, because Hull's are kind of, even in England, it's a strange city because we're relatively isolated from everywhere. You know, if to get to the nearest next place, it's an hour away to kind of reach a comparable city or a bigger city. So it's kind of a very much an isolated and forgotten place, you know, and it's kind of very much downtrodden and looked down upon by the media and by people who've never been to it. So it's always had this kind of sense of, you know, we abide by our own rules in Hull. You know, we do what we want. You know, our artists produce what they want, they write what they want, they make music as they want to. They're not necessarily influenced by fads or by other places in the same way that maybe other cities are. So it's always felt like, almost kind of like a republic on the tip of the country. And, you know, for me as a writer, that's a gift because not many people kind of come to the city. So I can kind of put it down on the page and explore it and try and explain it to people. And, you know, it's that sensitive that crime fiction allows us to travel, whether we're traveling to somewhere down the road that we maybe don't know, or we're traveling to somewhere else in the world, whether it's America or whether it's Scandinavia or Africa, wherever it may be. I think that's what crime fiction does really well, is allows us to explore different places and different people and different ideas. So, you know, it felt like when I started to write, I was only ever going to write about my home city. You know, even now, I struggle to write about places that aren't my home city. You know, I can get on Google Maps and I can kind of visit places and I can kind of look at them and try and feel them, but it doesn't feel as kind of natural about writing as my home city is.
What's your population in Nahal?
It's about 250,000. So it's kind of, I think it's about the 15th or 16th biggest city in England. It's not a huge city by any stretch of the imagination, but it's big enough to have people who are kind of, you know, completely destitute to people with stacks of money and influence and power within on a regional basis. So you kind of get that whole spread, you know, the whole kind of like geographical and social spread that you need for a crime novel, I think. You know, that's kind of what makes it exciting for me.
Oh, okay.
So better than or worse than Blackpool?
Well, we're on the other side of the country to Blackpool, so it's not somewhere I get to go to very often because I'm only half an hour from seaside resorts where I am, places like Scarborough and Whitby, which, you know, Whitby, obviously, that's kind of the setting for Dracula, isn't it? So that's kind of, that's a very popular sort of seaside place, where Blackpool, in my perception, is it's quite a run-down seaside town that kind of, again, like Hull needs investment, and it's probably not had it for a long time, but I do love that type of sort of slightly seedy seaside feel you get in those places. You know, you get criminals who are maybe quite small time, but they exert a lot of power in a small space, and that's kind of interesting as well. So I like places.
Yeah, when I was there last, we went to visit friends that had a place up in Blackpool, and I wanted to see what slappers were.
Okay.
so that was just it, you know, that was it for me. And let's just say it was fine. I didn't really actually notice. I actually didn't know why it had such a bad reputation.
Yeah. I think it's media, isn't it? You know, people get perceptions of places through the media. And, you know, certainly in England, a lot of these things are kind of very London centric. So it's kind of people writing about places from the comfort of their own offices in London, and they don't necessarily go to these places or even try and get under the skin of them particularly or try to understand them. So they kind of get kind of written off, I think. And, you know, Hull's been one of those cities that, since it lost its fishing industry back in the 70s, you know, it's been very much a place that's suffered from high levels of deprivation and hasn't really been given a fair crack, I don't think.
Is it building back up from the fishing community or?
Yeah, I mean, I think the great thing we've had in Hull over the last 10 years is we was awarded the title of UK City of Culture for 2017, which was great because it brought this kind of influx of money to the city to spend on the arts. And myself and my fellow crime writer in the city, Nick Tripper, we were very lucky that we got funding to put on a crime writing festival during the year-long festivities. So, you know, we got to bring, I think we brought about 40 crime writers from around the UK, people like Mark Billingham, Martina Cole, John Connolly, all kinds of brilliant authors to the city to talk about the work, and we programmed that festival, and it was fantastic. So, you know, the big thing in Hull is trying to build a future, I think, through culture and through leisure, essentially, you know, and it's kind of regeneration. So it kind of also throws up, as a crime writer, all kinds of interesting opportunities, because, you know, obviously where you've got money, you've got crime, and, you know, and as a writer, you've got a lot more scope there to kind of dream up scenarios where maybe you can't say it out loud in the actual real world.
So are you saying that you're in crime and that helps you out with your books?
Well, yeah. We watch carefully in the city. We know what's going on, I think, but yeah, you know, just when it has such a huge influx of money and influence and profile for a change, you know, it was such a, you know, you could kind of see how it changed people and how it changed perceptions and how people were trying to use it as a platform to sort of do their own thing. And it's very interesting as a crime writer to kind of just extrapolate from there and, you know, start asking questions about, you know, maybe what would happen if this was to occur or that was to occur. So yeah, well, you know, it was great. And the chance to program a festival as well was absolutely amazing. And it's something that we've carried forward and we kind of keep trying to plug away and keep putting it on.
Well, that's interesting. You know, when you're doing these crime books, how do you get into your characters? You know, of course your main character, but also the extra characters and the other people involved. So in order to write them, you kind of have to be fairly believable, right? The character has to be real. It has to have the correct feelings and the right behavior, so to speak. So what's that work like for you?
I think as a writer, a lot of it is kind of, you feel it in your gut, don't you? I think, you know, it comes through rewriting, I think, you know, I try and plan as best I can before I write a novel. And, you know, sometimes it's almost a cliche to say that characters take on a life of their own, but they do. And it kind of happens when you're not expecting it, and they do it in sort of strange ways. It's kind of, but I think it comes from convincing yourself first and foremost. So kind of, I spend a lot of time thinking, the actual time I spend on my laptop is probably very minor compared to the time I spend walking around thinking and just sort of exploring ideas in my head and how that would work, whether the character would actually do a certain thing or wouldn't do a certain thing. So I think it kind of comes from experience and your gut feeling and rewriting until I'm convinced as the author that character feels real. And often it doesn't happen first time for me, you know, it goes through numerous drafts. So yeah, it is tricky, isn't it, to try and get under the skin of a character, I think, but every character has to feel, I always try to remember that advice, that each character is the star of their own life, aren't they, you know, and although they're a minor character in the book, they've got their own story, they've got their own backstory, and they've got their own aims and dreams and ambitions, and I think that kind of something you have to drag out with them as you're writing.
So do your characters have flaws on purpose or that they work through?
Yeah, I think that's all kind of part of the arc, isn't it, when you're writing a story, you know, those characters have to kind of have some kind of journey that they go up on, and it has to kind of impact upon them, and they have to make, but you want them to make decisions, don't you, I think, as a writer, you want them to kind of make a decision and something that they will act upon, and how that will then feed into the story and give it momentum and propel it forward. And that's the important thing, I think, is that kind of giving them enough kind of they've got enough kind of skin in the game, haven't they? I think that's kind of what I'm stretching for. You want them to have kind of consequences in their actions. And that's, you know, that's important.
You know, in these books and crime fiction, I would imagine, okay, so there's going to be entertainment in it, and that's what you want. Mm. But there's also what, like a subtext? Are you hoping people take away something else from the book that's maybe written underneath?
I guess to a degree, yeah. I'm fascinated by sort of power and by money and how they kind of intersect each other. You know, even in a sort of like a relatively small city like Hull. So I guess I'm kind of always writing about power in some way. You know, maybe it's not. I'm even maybe not doing it deliberately myself. You know, I'm not kind of necessarily planning it out as an idea as such, but I am always kind of thinking about power and inequality and who has power and who has money and who doesn't have it. So I guess those are the things that kind of drive my novels, essentially, is that kind of sense of why society is ordered as it is, and kind of the consequences of that and who wins and who loses from that. So I guess that's the kind of underlying sort of basis of all my work in a lot of ways, but it's not something I'm kind of trying to think about too deeply, because as you say, it's about entertainment, isn't it? You want people to read a book and you want them to be entertained and go away kind of having enjoyed it and having maybe they've gone away, maybe they've kind of thought about something in a different way to how they have previously. But I think first and foremost, you read for entertainment, don't you, for pleasure?
Well, I think so, but hopefully. But you know, both Michael and I write in nonfiction and true crime, we can't really choose our ending, so to speak, and we can't really choose our character's behavior. I mean, I guess we could put some of our own feelings in on the characters involved, but it's not like you get to create that character, create the situation, and decide how it's going to end.
Yeah, that's true. It is, isn't it? And I think, you know, the ending has to be satisfactory, doesn't it, in that sense? You know, and I kind of like, I like loose endings as well. I like those kind of like loose threads where maybe kind of you have closed the story off in the sense of a big over arc, the arc of the story and the kind of like the overall solving of the main mystery within it. But within there, there'll be like threads that still dangle, you know, and a little bit of wriggle room for people. You know, and you know, I think as readers, we like to do a bit of work as well, don't we? We like to think about what we're reading, and we like to make our own minds up about the morality maybe behind a decision within a story. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of grey areas within that you can explore as a fiction writer. It doesn't have to just be black or white. You don't have to necessarily solve the mystery in the novel. But I think there's a balance there, isn't there? You know, it has to be kind of satisfactory for the reader, but also I think you can kind of play a little bit with it as well and be maybe kind of leave it with some open questions, which I guess is a bit tricky for you guys. Like you say, as true crime writers, it's more about, I guess, the resolution, isn't it?
Yeah, I lie a lot, so people don't know that it's not the truth. So that's how you work it, Nick.
I will knock that down. That's how
well, there you have it. Now you know. No, I think that, yeah, and I think there's a difference in the sense of, yeah, you can't really choose what the characters have already, that what they've done or are going to do in the book. It's kind of already there. So it's more about being able to find out the truth, except for in Michael's case, and pass that on to people so they try to understand, I guess. That's kind of how it is. Do you find a difference in UK mysteries and crime fiction as compared to American crime fictions?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, I do read a lot of American crime fiction, you know, as much as I read kind of the British stuff. But, I think it's kind of the themes and the aims of it are probably universal. You know, it's about the characters, isn't it, and their kind of journeys and the stories and places. So I guess I'm looking for the same thing regardless of where the book is that I'm reading is set. I don't necessarily see any great difference in that sense, really. Not fundamentally. I mean, like, you know, obviously you kind of get into the stuff where maybe if I'm reading a cop novel set in America, and you know, the law procedure is vastly different to what it is in a UK set novel, or the private investigator. Obviously subgenre is kind of a good one for that, isn't it? Because it's the kind of operate in a very different way. But I think fundamentally crime novels are the same wherever you pick them up. You know, it's about the character, and it's about the setting, and it's about themes that, you know, whether you write about Hollow, you're writing about New York, it's about power and about money and about revenge and about justice, and those kind of themes cut across all the crime novels, I think.
I always find the British ones a little bit more, the only word that comes to me is intelligent, but I don't want to use that. I just mean it's a little bit more, it's more of an investigation on people's behavior,
mm-hmm.
in a sense, than just that they did it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe it depends on the books, doesn't it? Because, you know, I'm kind of thinking of something like the Michael Connelly books, and I kind of see them as being very much the other side of the coin to Ian Rankin's Rebus novels. You know, and I would certainly say those are very satisfying mysteries and investigations in a way that a Rebus novel is. You know, Bosch and Rebus are kind of almost like long-lost brothers, aren't they, really? So I guess, you know, it just depends on what you're reading, I think, doesn't it, and that kind of subgenre. But, yeah, I mean, I guess the kind of the particularly when you talk about thrillers, and obviously the US kind of has the advantage on that, don't they? Because obviously you have the likes of Reacher running around with guns and whatnot, and it's kind of a very different scenario. You couldn't set those type of novels in England, could you? I don't think. It just wouldn't kind of work.
You know, you're not running around with guns.
Well, not always, at least at the moment. I think some subgenres work better than others, don't they? I think in certain countries, I guess. But no, I think, you know, there's plenty to kind of like in both. I think, and you can kind of find it if you want to, I think, as a reader.
Yeah, and you, during your, I guess, some of your writers, you've had Lee Child, you know, and he's quite a writer with Reacher, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I've had the pleasure of interviewing Lee at the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival, you know, and he's a massive supporter, isn't he, of crime writing in all these kind of shades and colours, you know, and supports writers amazingly well. But those novels are kind of very, they could only be set in America, I think.
You couldn't. That wouldn't work in.
Yeah, there was a Reacher novel set in the UK, wasn't there? At least partially set in the UK. I can't remember which one it was now, but it wasn't. I don't think it really worked particularly, not for me as a reader. You know, you want Reacher in those kind of small Midwest towns, don't you, where he's kind of isolated from everywhere else, and he gets involved in all sorts of mysterious trouble, like on the. I guess you guys have maybe seen the Amazon series that's just been on as well.
Yeah, I just saw it. It's pretty good, but yeah, you couldn't work that in any other country, really. I mean, you know, that setting and the behavior is something that would be very hard to pull off in the UK.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, people maybe know Simon Koenig. You know, he's a brilliant thriller writer, and his kind of UK thrillers have that kind of very much up against the clock feel against them, and you know, they're very fast paced, and there's people kind of screeching around the country, and they're around the countryside and with guns and with kidnapping people, and there's all sorts of stuff going on, and they're probably as near as I think we get to that kind of reach a template, really. But yeah, it is very rare that I think you pick up a UK thriller that works, like a Lee Child book or maybe a Linwood Barclay book or that, you know, those type of thriller writers.
Well, interesting that like from, you know, across the Atlantic, we think of London, but Hull is so much different. Do you purposely try to kind of separate that or try to get the kind of the experience what you would get in Hull?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, the UK, I mean, obviously it's a small country, isn't it? But every kind of, every area has its own character, you know. And I think, you go to Edinburgh with Ian Rankin, and that's kind of very much a university city, and it's a red brick city, and it's kind of very different to what Hull's like, you know. And then you kind of go across to somewhere like Liverpool, and again, that's very different. And London, obviously, is a global city, isn't it? Essentially, you know, it's a melting pot of people and of cultures, where other maybe cities like Hull, which are kind of 200 miles away, aren't as developed in that way. So yeah, I think it's about trying to get the character of a place onto the page, and that's kind of what I want to do with Hull. But yeah, I think you have to be careful that every place has its own kind of character and flavor, and that's kind of important, I think, as a writer to draw that out, really.
It's interesting how you have the the private investigator, and you said kind of like in America, and we start with actually Sherlock Holmes with the private investigator, then it goes to America. Now you're back in Hull.
yeah, exactly. And I think, I just kind of wanted to do that because you don't tend to see an awful lot of private investigator novels set in the UK. I don't kind of understand why, really, because you're writing fiction, so you can kind of play a little bit loose and fast with how all the kind of work that a private investigator actually does in the UK, because generally speaking, it's serving legal papers, it's surveillance, it's not particularly exciting work. But why shouldn't they be kind of getting involved in all kinds of mischief and getting under the skin of the police a little bit more? So it just made sense to me to try it and put it in a contemporary city. And, you know, I like doing that. It's kind of, I think, you know, if you're writing a police novel, then obviously you've got the procedure to deal with, and you've got kind of got this place, a police officer can't necessarily do certain things, or a private investigator answers to nobody. And I like that as a writer, that I can take him anywhere and just see what happens with him. You know, you can kind of face the consequences of his actions in a way that a police officer maybe wouldn't in a novel, I think.
Now, your books, each one of them, they will stand alone. Like, someone doesn't have to go through all four books.
No. They stand alone. I think kind of that's, as a writer, that's the aim, isn't it? You want a series work which rewards readers who kind of go all the way through them, but you want them to stand alone as well at the same time. And, you know, very much Sound of the Sinners, which is kind of the fourth book, but it's the start of a new cycle, really. So it's a good jumping in point, I think, because Joe's been away from the city for 5 years. He's been out working in Holland. He's come back because his old partner has died in a mysterious hit and run incident just outside of the city. So he's kind of compelled to come back and look into this. So it's kind of like a reset, really, of the characters, I think. I think Sound of the Sinners is a really good point to jump in as a reader. And that was certainly the intention, yeah.
How do you feel your characters? Is that like...
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Do you like hear them as people? Do you hear voices? Do you see them visually? How is it for you?
Yeah, I don't see them. I mean, that's kind of, I've never seen Joe Geraghty's face. You know, I know a lot of writers kind of say, don't they, you know, in the dream world, I would cast this actor as my lead protagonist, but I've never seen Joe Geraghty's face. All I know about him really is that he's a small man because he used to play rugby league, which is kind of a defining sport in the region and the city. And he was a scrum half in the game, so that's kind of generally people were kind of underneath 5'10" effectively. So I know he's a small man. I know he's about 40, but I can't see his face. I've never been able to see his face. It's more about the dialogue. I kind of play it in my head essentially. You know, I kind of like to kind of mumble the scenes to myself as I'm walking around, which probably isn't great when you're walking around the streets, is it? But
no.
That's kind of how I pick. You know, that's how I kind of pick it up. It's through the dialogue, really, never through the visuals, which is I've never seen him, and I don't think I want to see him as well.
Yeah, so just look for Nick walking around the streets mumbling to himself and kind of acting out these action scenes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Elmore Leonard, and I think, you know, if you're a fan of Elmore Leonard, you're a fan of dialogue, aren't you, basically? So I think that's kind of how I kind of find the character, you know, it's through the dialogue really more than the actual visual stuff. That's how I kind of get into it, I think.
And the other characters, he interacts with, are they just people you've come across in your life or you've seen?
A little bit. I mean, I guess it's kind of drawn on everything. You kind of drawn on your own experience, aren't you? So I guess his relationship with Don, which is kind of very much a father figure to Joe. You know, he's kind of a man who's an ex-detective. He's been there and done it. So I guess there's an element there of kind of, I'm thinking about my own relationship with my father. You're always drawing on your own kind of, your own history, I think, aren't you? And your own kind of, your own knowledge and your own kind of understanding of what the world is to you. I think characters generally, they tend to be kind of like composites of people I maybe met as I've been kind of moving around and just living, really, you know, whether it's through work or through other things. You know, you kind of always pick up interesting little traits that other people have, don't you? Or maybe things that they say, and you kind of maybe incorporate that into a character, and it becomes kind of a, you know, you have to discard a little bit as a writer because you obviously don't want people kind of pointing the finger and saying that's me. So I think just living really is kind of how you kind of create these characters. Is everything just goes into a great melting pot and comes back out again in its own kind of way.
Well, I'm sure you kill off people you don't like.
Yeah. It's always tempting, isn't it? It's very tempting to do that. So, yeah. I mean, I'm in the process of moving house at the moment, so maybe my next time I might kill off a mortgage advisor or a solicitor or something like that, possibly. So, we will see. Yeah, I like that about writing, you know, that being able to get things out on the page, you know, when maybe, you know, there are things you don't like about the world or about a specific situation or a specific person, but you can always kind of get it on the page and kind of cleanse yourself of it, I think, you know, whether it's on the national stage, whether there's a politician I don't like, you know, I can maybe incorporate that into a novel and I can kind of work from my feelings and kind of get all out of me and onto the page, onto that character. Or you say maybe it's more personal, where it's something, you know, that's happening in my own kind of life, maybe, that I want to kind of think about and explore. And writing is a great way of doing that, I think. It's kind of like cheap therapy, isn't it, I think, for us writers.
Do you have a favorite antagonist?
I don't really, with them being kind of mysteries, I don't think, it tends to be a separate one in each book, so there isn't one that kind of recurs, I don't think, in that sense. I like discussing organised crime in the books, just these kind of like small-time criminals who kind of wield an awful lot of power in a city. I think I should try and create one who can kind of stay the course a bit longer across those books, and I can kind of have them kind of ups and downs between him and my protagonist. An antagonist and reader are always great, isn't it? They're always great fun to read, and I suspect they're great fun to write as well.
What kind of influences do you have?
In terms of writers, I think I always kind of go back to people like Ian Rankin, you know, that sense of place he has when he writes about Edinburgh, you know, that was kind of really inspirational to me when I started to write. I kind of knew I wanted to write about Hull, and what Ian was doing with Edinburgh was very much the template for that, I think. It was kind of like the gold standard for writing about a city and how it changes and how power kind of quietly kind of influences what's going on within it. And as I mentioned, Elmore Leonard as well, you know, Elmore Leonard and his dialogue, I think, is just untouchable, you know, so you can't not like Elmore Leonard's dialogue, can you? You can just read pages of his characters just talking to each other about anything in a car. So that love of dialogue is something that's kind of come through, I hope, strongly in the novels. So yeah, those are the main two, really. But I am a big reader of crime fiction generally. So, you know, I kind of love things from one end of the scale, like the Reacher novels through to sort of psychological mysteries. And I've kind of developed a bit of a thing for spy novels of late, which is kind of, I think that's been a lockdown thing for me. I never read Le Carré until fairly recently, and I've kind of working my way through those slowly but surely. So yeah, you know, I think it kind of comes from everywhere, doesn't it, as a writer? You kind of take it all and then you kind of mix it all up and it comes out, hopefully, in your own voice at the end. So that's kind of how it works for me. But I think probably away from writing, music is a huge thing for me. And when I was younger, when I was kind of in my teenage years and my 20s, I used to share a flat with a friend who was in a band. And they'd kind of released their own records, they booked their own tours. They were kind of like a completely independent unit, and that just that sense of people saying, right, we're going to do this, and this is how we're going to do it, was really kind of inspiring. Because, you know, when I was growing up in Hull in the 80s, it wasn't particularly the type of city where you were encouraged to do artistic things. You know, it was just kind of a mystery. It was something that kind of didn't exist in my type of life or my family's life at that point. So meeting the right people, doing the right things at the right time was incredibly inspirational to me, and kind of what gave me permission to then start writing, really. You know, that sense of watching other people doing what they wanted to do made me, kind of empowered me to go out and do what I wanted to do, which was write crime novels.
Would your readers be surprised by anything you listen to or do? You know, like, you know, you listen to maybe something or read something and they'd be like, wow.
I don't know, really. I don't know. I guess, I mean, I'm a massive fan of, I'm a massive football fan. I always played football when I was younger, or, you know, or maybe sort of soccer to more listeners, I guess.
Yeah.
And that type of thing, you know, people don't tend to sort of think you can be kind of into the arts and into sport, do they? There seems to be a bit of a kind of a, those things don't necessarily cross over a lot of the time, you know, but that's kind of part of who I am and what I've always done and what I've always enjoyed. So I guess that's kind of, I don't know, you get the sense, maybe I'm digging into some sort of class thing there, certainly in England, where, you know, you're into the arts, but you're into sports, and one thing is high culture and one thing is low culture. But I've always loved both things, reading and sports. So yeah, I don't know, maybe that's something that people might find a little bit interesting.
I thought maybe you're practicing ballet or something.
That would be good, wouldn't it, if I could do that. Generally, if I'm not writing, I'm reading, or I'm trying to kick a football around still, even though I'm probably too old to be doing that, really. beyond that, I think writing just becomes such an all-consuming passion, doesn't it? You know, I think for all of us who write and read, it becomes such a great part of our lives that there's not time to do an awful lot else beyond that, I think. But I suspect it probably would be quite healthy to do something else like that. But I wish I could turn my brain off and be able to just, you know, like you say, collect stamps or do some ballet or whatever it might be. I just can't do
that's it. What Michael does that. Michael writes Jack the Ripper, and he wears a little ballerina outfit.
Well, I take pictures of it, and then I put in my Halloween decorations and stuff. You know.
But that's the only fans content.
That's how he fools people, you know. Yeah.
That's right.
Well, what's your writing structure then? Like, how do you find yourself writing? Do you can you just scheduled time that you have where there's nobody around where you're living and it's quiet, or do you have to be in a certain mood to do it? Like, where does it go for you?
Yeah, I'm very lucky that I kind of do a combination of things. I work part time in a regular job, and kind of the last 5 years, the most important thing has been getting my daughter to school and back every day. So that's become my thing. So the school day, generally speaking, when I'm not working in other areas, is my writing time. So I quite like the fact that I have between kind of 9 o'clock in the morning to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon to write, you know, and that's kind of like set time. So usually I spend a couple of hours messing around too much on Twitter and Facebook, and then, you know, the clock will be ticking slowly around to school's finishing. So then it'll be a panic station, and then I'll start writing. But I like having that structure. You know, I'm very lucky that I've got a structure I can work with that kind of gets me writing. And like I said, I spend a lot of time kind of walking and thinking. So I'll generally take my daughter to school and I'll be thinking about what I'm going to write as I walk back. And then I'm kind of ready to hit the laptop, hopefully. So yeah, but like everybody, like, I'm kind of doing it around other things, you know, so it's kind of work, it's other commitments. I'm maybe grabbing an hour a night to do it. I'm maybe grabbing a bit of time on the weekend. It depends on what the deadlines are, I think, as much as anything. But yeah, you know, I feel quite lucky that I've got the chance to write at least part-time at the moment, which is good. So I just try and maximize that as best I can, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of all you can do there. You ever going to write other types of books? Do you think you'll venture into something different, comedy? Or?
No, I don't think so, to be honest. I say I'm such a fan of crime fiction as a genre and as a reader that it's the only thing I really want to write, really. I know I've kind of not got the urge to write in other genres. I guess if I was to do something else, it would probably be non-fiction. You know, I'd maybe like to write a book kind of about sport or maybe about music in some way. I don't know what the books would be necessarily, but I would like to try a non-fiction book at some point. But I think at the moment, I'm just kind of, my aim is just to keep writing, hopefully writing better and better crime novels, you know, and I just want to try and push that as far as I can, really. So yeah, you know, I've not got that kind of itch to write other things, particularly that. I know some writers enjoy that, don't they? But for me, I just want to write crime novels and try and improve the craft doing that, really.
Historically, in Hull, has there been any kind of like serial killings that you could maybe do some nonfiction from Hull, or?
There is kind of interesting stuff in the Victorian era that can be kind of written about. There's always interesting stories to tell, isn't there? It's just trying to find that fresh angle on them, I think, into that kind of new take on them that gives us a bit of insight through people's sort of new eyes, effectively. But yeah, it's not something I'm particularly looking for, and I think that's the difference. You know, I'm always kind of thinking about plots and about ideas, but I'm deliberately trying not to look at things like real life murders and real life crime, because I don't want to get that itch to write it. Maybe I just want to write fiction. So you know, maybe I'm kind of subconsciously turning the tap off there when I read about it. I'm not digging too deep into it, I don't think. But yeah, there's lots of opportunities, I suspect. Even in a smaller city like Culver, there'll be stories there, that I'm sure.
Sounds like you still, though, have to do research on, let's say, how private investigators work and the police force, how they relate to each other.
Yeah, I mean, to a degree. I mean, I like writing a private investigator, partly because you don't have to do as much research and as much procedural elements to it as a police character. So that was a big attraction to me, maybe because I just don't like doing that stuff. So yeah, I think that would probably be quite a drawback for writing nonfiction, wouldn't it? I really would have to kind of learn how to research properly and methodically and in a way that was kind of time efficient. So yeah, and it's a very different skill set, I think, and it's not one that I've kind of particularly wanted to get into just yet.
Right.
You also, the new home of Joe is Amsterdam. Do you have a particular reason for using Amsterdam?
Yeah, it's because Hull is connected by ferry across to Holland. You can jump on a ferry in Hull about this time of the night, about 7 o'clock p.m. And you wake up in Rotterdam the next morning at sort of 6 o'clock, and then you're only an hour away from Amsterdam. So there's always been a connection between Hull and Holland. And you kind of see it in the architecture of Hull as well. You know, there's kind of that very much that Dutch influence upon it. So yeah, there's always been that connection there, and it just kind of, you know, it just felt kind of logical. Like, if Joe was to go somewhere, then that's somewhere that's, it's a good distance away, but it's not too far at the same time. You know, there's always that connection. You're only a ferry ride away between the two places. So yeah, you know, and plus I like Amsterdam. I love going there as well. So it was kind of fun to write something, at least trying to imagine and picture living in that city and how that would then influence into the novel. So yeah, you know, it just kind of felt once I decided it wasn't in Hull anymore, I felt it had to go abroad somewhere, and Holland and Amsterdam just felt like the obvious choice for me, really.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. You know, he's having a good time with the pot.
Oh, yes. It's, yeah, it's one of those places where, you know, you live in, when you visit Amsterdam at different stages of your life, I think if you live in Hull, you kind of go as a teenager with your friends, you know, and you kind of enjoy some of the more nefarious opportunities that Amsterdam offers you. Then you kind of go back with a partner and you kind of see how beautiful it is as a city with the canals and the art galleries. And then you kind of go back with your children and you kind of see it through fresh eyes again. So it's kind of a, you know, it's very much a city that offers lots of different things to different people. So, you know, I think it'd be a great setting for a crime novel as well. So maybe when I do start writing about other places other than Hull, Amsterdam might be a good choice, I think.
Hmm. Certainly be fun to go investigate.
Yeah, and tax deductible as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of people, do you like people, or do you like, and I mean this, do you like having the world the way it is now, like the social media and all of that, and do you like people to interact, or do you get into all that?
I love Twitter, actually, which, you know, not many people seem to do they, but I really like that, you know, being able to connect with people all around the world, you know, whether it's through books or whether it's through sport or whatever it is. I just think it's such a great opportunity, you know. I mean, obviously it is and can be a cesspit, can't it? You know, if you kind of look in the wrong places, or you let yourself kind of get drawn down rabbit holes of politics and things like that. But I think on the whole, it's such a positive thing, you know, and it's been such a positive thing on my life as well, you know, and then really has enriched it, having some different people from all around the globe, being able to kind of interact with them and read their stories and read what's happening in their places. And yeah, I think it's great. I like it too much, I think, to be honest. You know, I could probably spend more time writing than less time tweeting, I think, would be wise advice to myself.
Hmm. So do you follow reviews, or does that matter?
I think any writer who says they don't look at them probably lies, don't they? You can't help but look at them. But I think, you know, you have to try and remain balanced, don't you? If somebody gives you a 5-star review and says you're the best writer in the world, then you should believe it. And if somebody gives you a 1-star review and tells you the worst writer in the world, you shouldn't believe it either. You kind of just got to try and just let it wash over you, I think, to a degree. You know, there's often kind of things you can pick out of them that are useful. But, I try not to get too bogged down in reviews, because, you know, you don't need an excuse to give yourself a kicking, I think, as a writer, do you? You know, if you're a writer who's kind of quite pleased with what you're doing, then I'd be a little bit worried, I think, really. You know, I think writers should be full of self-doubt about what they're doing and kind of questioning themselves as to whether what they're writing is the best they can produce, or whether it can, you know, whether they're doing it right. So yeah, you know, I think, you know, it's probably something you don't need to hear, I think, is reviews and criticism or praise, really. You just got to kind of focus in on giving the best way that you can and doing the best way that you can. And that's what counts ultimately, I think, you know, being able to kind of answer to yourself and be satisfied that you're giving it the best shot that you can and you're producing the best work you can at that point in time.
Well, hopefully I'll become like you, because right now I hunt down and kill the people that...
You know, that's what we're dealing with it, of course, isn't it? Yeah. It just tends to carry quite stiff jail penalties, I think, that, isn't it? So it's just tricky.
Only if you get caught.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've got to be careful with stuff like that.
Well, yeah. I have a pseudonym. I call myself Nick Quantrell, and I go out looking. Oh,
yeah. <Uh-oh>. I'm not looking to America anymore, or Canada.
Yeah.
I'm not looking to America anymore.
Yeah, look out. They'll be after you. You're on the no-fly list.
My passport's going to ping off, isn't it, when I go through it.
Yeah. It'll be like Nick Reacher. They'll be all over you with the gun.
Stop. Freeze.
Yeah. Down on the floor.
Probably nothing but a toothbrush.
Yeah. So now let's see. Now, are you running a website you want people to come visit you on, or do you, where do you want them to follow you on social media?
Yeah. So the best thing, I have a website, which is nickquantrell.co.uk, and I'm also on Twitter at that handle, at Nick Quantrell. And Twitter's the best way. You know, I'm always on Twitter, and I'm always interested in kind of what's going on. So yeah, Twitter's the best way. And also, check out our crime festival, Hull Noir, as well, which is, we're currently kind of applying for more funding to put it on again, but we're always doing stuff online as well. So, you know, I think that's been kind of the great win, hasn't it, the pandemic for writers, is that chance to do things online and how it's become kind of part of the landscape, I think, hasn't it, really? So, you know, we're kind of embracing that as much as we can as a festival and interviewing online and doing events online as well as in our home city. So, yeah, look us up on Twitter, Hull Noir on Twitter as well.
Sports-based fiction.
Yes. That just tempts me. It just tempts me. Yeah. I'm trying to think, you know, sometimes it didn't necessarily mesh with crime, does it, particularly well on the page, I don't think. But yeah, Sport Face Fiction, David Peace, who wrote the Damned United about Brian Clough, a great British football manager in the 70s, is an incredible, it's a noir novel, essentially. You know, it's kind of, you're inside the head of Brian Clough, who's this conflicted man between kind of what he, you know, he's kind of driven to be the best he can be. He's kind of got this antagonist who was another manager, Don Revy, who's got the job he wants, you know, and it's just kind of it's a novel being conflicted and about demons and about how they kind of drive you. And it's just, you know, it's a noir novel, but it's kind of marketed as a sports novel. So it can be done, but it's something I do think about. And I would like to get that idea that lets me kind of write a sports crime novel, but, you've also got to have an eye on the commercial aspect as well. I mean, I'm not sure people necessarily would want that particularly.
Mm. And do you always write your book with kind of like the characters? Is it always Joe that is the point of view in your book, first person?
Yeah, it is in these novels. It's a first person novel. So, and you know, with the occasional kind of filtering of maybe another point of view, or possibly like using things like newspaper reports or just kind of things like that, I can just sort of drop into break up a little bit. But the Joe Geraghty novels are first-person novels, but the novel I've just completed, which is a new character for me, it's a young female podcaster, that's written in the third person because I wanted specifically to bring in more than one viewpoint in the novel and make it a little bit more kind of thrillerish, I suppose, you know, where you can kind of, you can dip in and out of characters and situations and just kind of get a little bit more page turning in that sense, I think. So, yeah, you know, I like the first person as a writer. I think it's, I kind of like that medium, but it's important, I think, to mix it up, isn't it, and try different things and keep yourself on your toes, really.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. Do you find that would you have a problem writing yourself in first person as a female character, lead character?
Yeah, I mean, well, I did worry about that for a long time when I was writing the Geraghty novel. I kept thinking, can I write a female character? And for this novel I've written, although it's third person, you kind of just have to tell yourself to get over yourself, I think, don't you, to a degree? You know, it's not that different, really. You know, you kind of, this female character is a lot younger than Joe Geraghty, so, you know, she thinks differently and she likes different things and she has different ambitions and different hopes. But essentially, I think you're just writing people, aren't you? You're writing about conflict and you're writing about kind of what drives them as a person. So I've kind of tried not to get too deep into thinking whether it's male or female in that sense. It's about what that character wants and what they do, I think, more than anything. But yeah, maybe writing it actually in first person would be a little bit of a scarier prospect, possibly. But the great thing as a writer is you can just try it out. You don't have to show anybody. You know, you can just experiment and see how it feels. And, you know, I think, you know, when you get something right or when you get it wrong, and you know, so maybe that would be something to try out at some point, but
Yeah, just for Michael's ballet uniform. That's what he does. He gets in the minds of the victims of Jack. And
well, one of the things is, although I have a couple fiction novels, I got yelled at by my editor because I was head hopping too much. So different points of view, and I'd go around, and then she said that I was getting the reader exhausted, so I had to kind of do less of that. But yeah, so I just keep on, you know, just wear my little skirt, and we're all set.
Yeah. In the novel, I've got this. There's mainly two perspectives, you know, and I think possibly three perspectives is probably about the maximum I want to go to in terms of allowing people into other characters' heads, you know, because like you say, when you get too many, it becomes convoluted, doesn't it? And the story maybe repeats on itself a little bit too much because there's too many characters and they're not driving the plot forward enough. So, yeah, I think that's an important point. But it comes down to how you handle it as a writer, I think, doesn't it? And confidence in doing that, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely a nonfiction guy, so my editor tried to change me into a fiction person. It was fun as heck, but I am such a research-based kind of person. And then, so when Al and I talk about that stuff, it connects much better. But I'm so curious about how fiction writers are because it's a different world.
Yeah. You're the master of your own universe, aren't you? I guess in a way that you're not possibly. So, but then maybe sometimes you get too many possibilities as well. You know, you're kind of thinking, you know, what if this happens? What if that happens? And it's sometimes difficult to pick the right path through it all. And that's kind of, again, that's going back to listening to your gut, I think. You know, I kind of like to think that I can kind of sniff myself when I'm about to go off track maybe a bit too much, and kind of know when to rein myself back in, so I'm staying on the focus and I'm keeping on the path that will get me through the novel. But there's definitely a lot. You've got a million things you could choose from, haven't you, as a fiction writer, and that's sometimes tough to sort of just focus in on what it should be. And then maybe that's where you need the help of an editor, I think.
Mm. So stressful situations. How was COVID for you in the writing arena? Did it sort of affect your writing?
Yeah, well, it didn't affect my writing as such. I found the writing to be really kind of, to be such a useful thing. You know, it was kind of an outlet, really, because I've gone from having the house to myself because my daughter's at school and my wife's a teacher, so she was obviously out teaching. But then when COVID hit, they were both in the house as well as me. So it kind of became a bit of a different scenario in that sense. I was kind of sharing space that I wasn't doing before. But being able to just lose myself a few hours in a story and just writing was brilliant. You know, and I think, you know, that was such a boost on my own mental health in that time, really. What I found tough was reading. You know, I couldn't read contemporary crime fiction at the start of lockdown. I just found it too upsetting to read about characters walking into pubs for a drink or a bar or something, or doing stuff that we was taking for granted up until that point. And I kind of dug deeper into historical crime fiction and sort of new worlds, things that took me out of where I was. I found the actual writing to be really kind of, I was really thankful that I had the writing to focus on during COVID, particularly that first spell in the UK lockdown, that first sort of 6 to 9 months. I felt like a gift, really, to be honest. And I guess the downside was when Sound of the Sinners was published, it was during the pandemic, so it made getting out to promote it an awful lot harder. And, you know, like most writers, it went to the online arena and doing things there, which again, I think, you know, like I said, it's become a win, I think, for writers, isn't it, this online world. You know, we've now got the chance to connect through our laptops and through Zoom with writers and readers and places that we wouldn't necessarily been able to go to. So, you know, it's kind of definitely been kind of pros and cons, I think. But, I'm just pleased I kind of got through it unscathed and was able to kind of focus on the writing. And that was kind of a really sort of positive thing for me, really, in the last couple of years.
We all know. Well, it's been a great hour. So now the book we're talking about is Sound of the Sinners, Joe Garrotti, book 4. And the author is Nick Quantrell. Thank you for being on the show.
No, thank you both. Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Great speaking with you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.